Welcome to the pod, everyone. Bit of a shout out to SGS, who myself and Fletcher are going to do a little bit of work with. Hopefully make it the most innovative, impactful, effective coaching qualification in the country, industry ready, experiential, backed up with all the science and the evidence stuff. And just a brief word from them beforehand.
SGS College is the home of Bristol's higher education sports programmes. The programmes are designed to develop unique, innovative and creative sports practitioners ready for industry. Do you want to be a coach or teacher of the future? Start your journey here at SGS College and become more than just a graduate. Visit sgscol.ac.uk to apply now.
Cool. So second time lucky, Rusty on the pod with Aaron Walsh. Just to give you everyone a bit of context, last week we did a podcast. It was one of my favourite podcasts ever. However, it did not record. So we are back again. We're going to exactly replay every single second of that podcast, word by word, second by second. And we've both got scripts. So, mate, Aaron, how are you, mate? You well?
Yeah, good, mate. Lovely to be back with you again. I can see that nice red recording button on, so that's bringing me much comfort and peace.
Oh, mate, I felt terrible. So I'm a measure of the man that you forgave me immediately. And,
mate, we just saw it as a test run, so, you know, a bit of a rehearsal.
Nice. And also mindful that, well, you guys are lucky. You got a game of rugby coming up in a day, 2 days.
Yeah, I think a couple of days out now. So it sort of like went real quick. So it went from you've got rugby till it's going to be really, really heavily regulated to no, you've got rugby and you can go on a normal aeroplane and the whole ground's going to be full.
Yeah, so the ground's filling as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, so they've sold 50,000 tickets between the two grounds. I think that's what I heard tonight on the news. So between Eden Park and Forsyth Bash, I think should be a full house.
Wow. And everyone in the UK is scrambling to get Sky so they can watch some live rugby.
Yeah. Well, I think you guys still have some big power, mate, because originally the game's going to be 5:10 on Saturday and now they've been moved to 7:10 our time. So I imagine that's to help the Northern Hemisphere audience not have to get up in the middle of the night.
Oh, nice. Apologies for that. Apologies.
No.
mate, look, thanks again for coming on. I've been looking at your kind of work and listening to some of your stuff and seeing you as the, I think we called you the most improved man on LinkedIn. Game, connecting followers, connecting up with people. Do you want to kind of explain what brought you to that moment where you became the most improved man on LinkedIn?
Yeah, I think to put it in context, I reckon I went from a negative 0.5 out of 10 to a 2. so it's not like I've gone to an 8. But I guess for me, it was just at the beginning of lockdown. I was actually probably a year ago, Stuart Lancaster, I know he's, you know, got so much admiration for a lot of us in the rugby world. He wrote something that kind of stimulated a lot of thought for me, and it was about sharing of ideas. And I think it was really, Wayne Smith also, I think, captures some of the same notion, is that when you share ideas, two really awesome things happen. The first thing is all the ones that aren't strong get exposed. So I really like that. But then the other side of it was the ones that hold weight, they survive. And so, you know, as I got to the beginning of lockdown, I thought, you know, there's sort of, I don't know, there's sometimes a bit of secrecy in high performance sports. It's like, you know, we have the corner on A, B and C, and, you know, you watch all those Amazon things and about teams. No one has the corner on high performance. There's no one. So like, why wouldn't we just share ideas? So I thought, I'm going to put out the concept of, I'm going to do a mental skills 3 weeks in a row. I'm going to call it normalizing mental skills for teams. And anyone who's sort of on a team or leading a team or part of a team, jump on. And I think I told you, it was like, if we get 10 per week, it'd be like I've just had a blinder. So ended up over those, I think, 3 weeks, about 400 people getting on. So, but what it did to me, it wasn't like, you know, I'm awesome. That's not what I felt at all. I felt like there's a real hunger for this subject. And we were sort of beginning to touch on that, I suppose, like beginning to see people going, yeah, I really understand. I suppose the best way we've talked about, mate, we understand the importance of mental skills, but still don't know how it looks on a team, still don't know how to implement it, and still a little bit confused about how we would normalize its role within performance.
Nice. I'm going to ask you about the journey to get to this point.
Yeah.
Actually, why do you think people don't share stuff? Because I'm with you. And I love the idea that actually kind of road tests stuff. But actually, how I also see it is, well, I share an idea, someone else makes it even better. And quite frankly, we all get them.
Yeah. And I think also a good friend of mine, David Galbraith, who was with the Chiefs a lot of years in the mental skills space, he would always say the sharing of ideas force you to find new ones. Yeah. And I reckon that's the magic. Like, you give something away, then you go, man, I got to up my game here. Like, there's an actual motivation around that too. Like, you know, like, because, you know, as a coach or doing these sort of things, if you only got three ideas and four stories after your fourth podcast, you're done. So, like, everyone's heard them. So, you know, that's sort of been part of it. So my sort of journey into it's a little unconventional, which is sort of an adapt sort of description around my whole life in this regard, I suppose, is that I'm not formally trained. So I never went to university and studied psychology. I sort of fell into it by mistake. And I spent a lot of time in the US in the 2000s. And one of my roles was to work with in Major League Baseball with sort of what I probably back then would sort of term as a player well-being, sort of player development sort of role, where I actually worked for an agency and my role was to make sure that their players who were quite high profile just didn't do anything stupid. And, you know, it was sort of a win was that they don't get arrested or suspended. But sort of what I found out is like a few years into this, they weren't getting anything in the mental skills department. Like there was no one really saying, you're really, really good and you've got amazing potential. You think about this, all the people that get drafted in baseball, but you can't deliver on it. We're not seeing you delivering on it. And so I remember I was sitting in Phoenix as it's spring training. It must have been like 04, 05. And I'm sitting across and I'm looking across this field. And at that point, there's probably eight teams and I don't know, maybe 500 young athletes. And I'm like, this is unbelievable. And they all look the same. They were amazing. And I said to the guy, what percentage of these guys will play in the major leagues? And he said, well, you know, only 3% of people that get drafted ever put on a big league uniform. And I said, what do you reckon the difference is? Because they all look amazing. They all like ripped and they all hit and throw the same. He said, some can deliver under pressure and some can't. And that was sort of like this genesis moment where I sort of began to go, well, I wonder if we've been looking at it the wrong way, which is, do we think that people's relationship to pressure is some personality trait that they possess that's been formed in their upbringing, or do we actually think it's a skill you can work on and get better at? And so that was sort of the beginning point where I went, what if you can train people to think well? And why wouldn't we even want to approach it that way, right? Like we think people can get better physically and we think people can get better skill-wise. Why don't we think they can get better at thinking? So sort of my joke around it all, mate, it's cheesy, but someone like yourself will appreciate it, is that I think we have a fixed mindset around mental skills.
I would tend to agree. I think we often put, in lots of places, we often put people in boxes very easily, that they can and can't do stuff. They're this, they're that, they're not this. There's a couple of things I wanted to pick up on. One was pressure. So when you use the word pressure, what does that mean to you? And then you started then to talk about, could we train people to deal with that? What's the stuff you discovered, I think, when we chatted last time, and we were already off script, seriously, Aaron. We chatted a little bit around what's the limitations of training that, you know, so you can't put necessarily 80,000 in your training venue, as an example.
Yeah.
So, where does that all fit from a training pressure point of view for you?
So, I think pressure is, I think it's a social issue. Like I think I talked to you about this before. So pressure exists because people exist. And so you think about all of those moments where, you know, we, like I play golf. So I can sit with three of my really good mates. I can stand on a tee. I don't feel any pressure. And the reason I don't feel any pressure is because socially I know I'm not going to be judged, right? There's no, they're not going to judge me. They're just going to love me and accept me, right? So what changes when you put 200 people around that same scenario and all of a sudden my heart rate elevates, my hands begin to sweat and I'm shaking and I can hardly put the ball on the tee. So nothing about my golf game's changed. Nothing about my body's changed in those moments. The only thing that's changed is socially. Now there's people there, and what those people carry is the ability to judge me. And in that judgment, they make a value over who I am as a person according to the skill that I can and cannot perform in front of me. And so when we experience pressure, what we basically experience is pressure provides the opportunity to fail, which in then turn produces judgment, which attacks us at the core of who we are.
So you're helping people understand more about who they are, I guess.
I reckon the number one piece of work I do is on identity. And I was talking to a friend today about this, and I just said, I think identity is the golden thread of mental skills. And what I mean by that is that if you don't have an identity that is not reliant upon your performance for you to generate self-worth, then the performance space is going to be a really unhappy space for you. And I think I find there's so many athletes there whose mood, well-being, self-esteem is completely reliant upon performance. And so I suppose the best way I describe it, sort of look at it the other way, what could be helpful for people is, so for a rugby player, I would say, now rugby is not the place where you get your identity. Rugby is the place where you express your identity. It's the canvas that you have in front of you right now. But you don't know how to express your identity if you don't know who you are. So the first point of reference is, who are you? What's important to you? And what does that look like for you to be authentic to that on a rugby field?
Have you seen that kind of translated by coaches? So I'm immediately thinking of, you know, we chatted a bit around belonging and,
We have quite an amazing way here in New Zealand, I think, of describing that. And it's called whakapapa, which is a Māori word, which basically would be translated. I'm doing a very poor job here, so I'll get corrected. But it's a bit of our story, our journey, and our lineage. So the concept of whakapapa would say, for example, you know, the jersey I have on today, if I was to wear a jersey that represents my nation, I'm just not standing in this moment of time trying to find out who I am from the jersey that I have on me. I have to look backwards. And I'm looking back into my history, I'll find stories, I'll find experiences. And so I think we all know about the concept of legacy. I think that James Kerr referred to was whakapapa was a big concept, was that the All Blacks understood that they just weren't putting on a jersey that was relevant to that day. They were putting on a jersey that had a real history behind it, and there were stories, and there was an identity thread, I suppose, is probably the biggest way to describe it, that sat within those stories. And so those identity qualities were unique to the people you're representing. So I think we talked about last week, as New Zealanders, we're going to have a really different identity story, say, to the German or to the Americans or even to the English. And that's part of our history. So, you know, that then formulates our identity. And then also we then look forward and say, well, in the future, when we're gone, what identity thread do we want to remain for the people that would inherit the jersey after us? And so that's in a team sense, but in an individual sense, it would be saying, like I said to you, Rusty, mate, go and have a look back 5 generations. I reckon you'll find 3 qualities that have been shining through your family. I reckon that's your identity. You don't have to go find it in a test today. It's already there. It's sitting within your roots and your DNA and your lineage. That's who you are. Go find out who that is. And I reckon that'll resonate deeply with you. Then you figure out, what does it look like on a footy field?
Nice. When you moved back from the US to New Zealand I think you came over and worked with the women's football team? Let's translate that kind of, still feels quite high order. Translate that to, you know, some of your work in that environment.
So we would do 2 things. So we'd look at, one, the team that's been represented, and 2, the people that are representing that team. So here's what I mean by that. We asked 2 questions. What have been the common threads that have been in the history of women's football in New Zealand? That was the first question. And the second question was, that was a history question, okay? And the second question was, what makes young Kiwi women exceptional? And how do we use that as a competitive advantage? And so it sort of molded those two stories together, and we sort of came up, you know, with these sort of things, which is we find a way, which is a really Kiwi thing. So that was a real important thing. So no matter what, we'll find a way. We're at the bottom of the earth. We're on number eight fencing wire. Guy like Hillary is a prime example of that, right? You know, Sir Ed, after he climbed Everest, was asked, you know, why did you climb it? And his answer is real simple: because it was there. So, you know, well, it's there. So let's find a way to get up the thing. And so that's a real Kiwi thing, because we don't have, we're not in the center of Europe. We don't have access to technology. So that was a real big one. Then we look after our own, which is another real Kiwi thing. So we understood that our connection to each other, being from a small country in the bottom of the Southern Ocean, was going to be a competitive advantage. We'd grown up with each other. We'd played with each other. All those girls knew each other from under 12s, if that made sense. Like, they weren't this glorified all-star team from all the regions throughout a big, massive country. They knew each other. They grew up with each other, and they really liked each other, and they really enjoyed each other. And then I think the final thing we talked about was punching above our weight, which was this whole sense of, just on any given day, we can do unbelievable things. And our history would suggest that New Zealand football has all these massive, like, upsets and overachievements in them. So, you know, it doesn't mean much to anyone, but in 2010, our men's team went to the World Cup in South Africa and never lost a game. They had three draws in their pool play. Yeah. They drew with Italy. Like, how do we draw with Italy? You know, that's like Italy's drawing with the All Blacks, right? Like, it just is. But on our day, and so... So they then became this thing of, we will fight, we'll find a way. We will look after each other, we'll stay connected. And we'll have belief and hope that on our day, anything is possible. So that became the identity of a team. Does that make sense? And so how does that translate? Like, you know, I could probably paint you one picture. One picture is in November 2018. And this team had just been through a really difficult time, a review that was both embarrassing and confronting. The removal of a head coach, the removal of the football staff, and the restarting of a thing 8 months before a World Cup. You can't even imagine that, right? So that's one contrast. And we took them to a beach in the West Coast, New Zealand, and talked about what it meant to come back together again, rediscover who we are, and recapture that identity that was lost somewhere in the number of previous years. And the other story is, I think it was June 3rd, I still had it written down, 2019, which is 8 months after it, Brighton. In the south of England, and we're the first New Zealand team to ever beat an English team at any level at football. And the girls beat 1-0 England in the World Cup send-off in Brighton. And you went, they found a way, they stayed connected, and on their day, they did an impossible thing. So that was the authenticity of an identity being expressed through a performance that gave great confidence that you just don't know what we could do as a team, which I think maximized capability rather than reduced it.
How would that be facilitated? Would that be you? Would that be a coach? Would that be them? Yeah. How does that feel authentic? Because I can definitely imagine some environments and, you know, where that might not be the case.
I think it's always contextual, mate. So I think, you know, if you have an experienced team that are quite connected to their history. So I'll give you an example. Like, you know, there's teams like probably someone like the Chiefs, who I've gone and been part of their community this year, is that they have a pretty rich identity story that's been developed over a decade through many different people. So, you know, the last thing for me would be do is try and go and redefine that, challenge it. Like, and that's so contextually, then you support the story and look at how to keep it fresh. That would be, but then sometimes you got other teams who don't, like, I'll get, you know, I think, you know, one of the examples would be looking at a team who has a false identity story. Okay, so, or because they have an identity vacuum. So, you know, I worked in a team in the NRL where they were very much, their identity story is underachieving, you know, a little bit lazy and disinterested, and very, very unpredictable and inconsistent. Because they had an identity vacuum, the media had created that narrative, and that narrative just became common. I didn't get brought in by the team, but it was certainly the story that was pervading the team narrative, if that makes sense. So we then had to almost start and go, well, this is what the media say about you. And it's probably true at the moment. What do we want to say about us? And how do we go about creating that? And that was then, you know, sort of like, in some sense, going back through history and finding out the key moments in the history of the team and what those moments displayed, and seeing if we could find some commonality. And then also relating that back to the group of people. So, for example, in that team, high Polynesian population, young Polynesian men who love to express themselves, have fun and play. Okay, so we could never ever take that out of the identity. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's a layered work, and it's a contextual work. But I think it's a foundational work, because then all of a sudden, when it comes to analyzing performance, the concept of measuring your authenticity to your identity becomes a non-outcome success measure that I think is really helpful.
And how do coaches, I mean, so you must have encountered some coaches, yeah. But hang on a second, Aaron, this is, I've got to win some games here. I've got to get the tech stuff right. And clearly they would. This, however, you and me would probably believe this is integral to performance. How are you persuading people? How are you supporting people with this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question is never an either or. Like, do we do work on the environment? Do we do work on mental skills? And then do we also, or if we do that, then we can't do work on the game? Mm-hmm. No, I would say that this is the thing that once the technical and physical work is done, that enables that now to be translated into proper performance by having an environment where people are free to express themselves. And so if we think about an identity thing, like you think of some an identity thing, like if we say courage is an identity anchor, I'm just saying that just as a, because it's one that's quite common. The role of the coaches then is to translate that into a game, right? So what does that look like during the game, and how do we measure whether we're being authentic to courage? So it might be look like jackalope breakdown, right? That could be a real way. How many steals did we get at the breakdown? You know, it might be selfless. It might be just all these clean outs that no one wants to do. And it's, we've got people there that, and I think Wayne Smith talked about this when he went back to the Chiefs in, I think, 2011 and 12, and they sort of went on that Moneyball sort of experiment. And what they were trying to do is create, and I think they did some wonderful work around a Moneyball-ish sort of measurement for character in rugby, and what that would look like on the field, and what were the things that were behaviors on the field that would indicate we got high character players. And so they were all the things that probably were unnoticed and unseen, but they thought were really critical to performance. And they wanted men and recruiting men that would do that, which would again go back to we're recruiting people who represent who we are, but also we have a clarity. So it's not just up on the wall. We can see it in our game when we're actually being true to that.
And how are coaches around that stuff with you? So when you suddenly start talking about we're going to measure character on the pitch, or often people are measuring actions, would be my view. Yeah. And we're measuring stuff traditionally that we've always done. What about, I mean, maybe you're going into self-selecting environments, but are there places where you've gone in, I think we had, maybe where you're just like, they don't want me here.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of like, I think you would probably understand this. Like, I think as I've got a little bit older and experienced and perhaps a little bit more confident in the work that I do, my whole principle is feed the hungry. If you don't want me here, I'm not going to be here. And that's above everything. Like, I'm not coming in to convince you that you need me. So if you don't have a value for the mental side of performance, or you don't have a value for how much an environment can bring out the best or not bring out the best in people, or you don't have an appetite for how we can have identity anchors that are going to be really, really critical to us being true to ourselves. If you don't want any of that, then I'm not even going to spend 5 minutes in there. Because the worst thing is to try and get in there and, you know, convince the fool that they need to be hungry. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, I would talk about following the energy. I'm definitely enjoying feeding the hungry.
Yeah. I mean, it's even with the players too. Like, I don't want to work with players that don't want to grow mentally. Like, what's the point? I mean, if it's an instruction and education piece and they don't actually know where it sits within the performance and they need to actually see it for what it is, and then and seeing it for what it is, then they want to grow. But if they understand it as a part of performance, but they one might not be vulnerable, they might not be courageous enough, or they're actually just really content with where they're currently at, then there's really not much I can do at that point. You know, I can lay out the menu, but I can't make people eat.
You give them the option, I guess. It's some
give them the option.
Whether or not they want to eat. Yeah.
And I think when I was probably younger and a bit more insecure, I would think that their appetite to grow in this part of the game. If they didn't have that, then it was personal, like it was me. And, you know, I think there's plenty of people in the mental skills space that don't help the development of mental skills because they lay out something so daunting that even if someone did have an appetite, it's really difficult for them to get into.
Have you ever had anyone that didn't want to eat and then they came back a year or two later and realized they needed to eat?
Yeah, failure is a really good stimulus for hunger, isn't it?
Yeah, that's, and I was thinking, because when you were speaking earlier about a relatively young sports person and them owning their development and coming to you and going, look, I need this, I need this type stuff. I mean, I was thinking at the time, like, what got that person to that stage? But I guess I'm assuming your view is that, they've got to want to come to you rather than there's no point in me just kind of forcing stuff upon them.
And it's sort of an interesting one because, you know, mate, in the teens world, my work can be seen as an optional piece of work. So it's not like you can go to a trainer and say, I'm not doing gym this week. I don't feel like it. You know, or it's not like you can go to one of your coaches and say, oh, I'm out this week. Like, you know, those field sessions, I'm just not into it. But yet we've created a scenario where maybe it's mental skills have just been delivered in a poor way, or it's been siloed in an unhelpful way, or it hasn't been explained and how it actually does affect performance, or, you know, how you can approach it as a skill, how you can grow it. But we still tend to think around the mental side of performance, we make it optional. And I guess I may be biased in that regard, but part of normalizing it, I think, is not making it compulsory in a weird way, but we would never ever think of saying to a player, gym's optional this week. Just if you feel like it, go. Then why do we say to our players, developing yourself mentally is an optional task for you this week?
And I know there's not going to be one answer, but what's your kind of view? What are your considerations in designing a week around developing mental
skills? Well, I mean, it's, you know, like I go back to, if they can't practice it, they can't implement. And if it's not practical, they can't practice it. So, you know, I sort of, as a big value for me in the mental skills space is people aren't looking for philosophers, they're looking for tradesmen. And so though it might be important to undergird at times the why am I asking you to do this task? Why do I think this is going to be important to your performance? You know, why would I want you to plan your week? Why would I want you to have routines? You know, why would I want you to have clear outline of the goals that you want to accomplish? You know, why would you go do breathing, or why would you do visualization? Like, those, sometimes they're helpful, right? It's like saying to someone, you know, hey, we want you to do bench press. We're not going to go into the whole role of why the chest is important in scrummaging. We're just going to say, we need to get you stronger, mate. And here's one way of getting you stronger. So I think we have a lot of philosophers in some teams, and they come, I'm not being, you know, negative here, but I think at times it comes from a over-focus on the academic part of it. So if you're someone who's really highly academically trained, but they've never had experience, that's a challenging thing, because they've got to take that information now and they've got to apply it into someone that needs to be able to have something practical to develop a skill during the week. So once again, going back, if it's clinical only, which is around personality traits, rather than also being skill-based, which is around how can we train you, I think that's probably, to me, one of the reasons why people haven't brought into it.
Yeah, what? And let's go on pitch then. So let's go. Really, some of the stuff you're doing will be like off pitch. So you chatted about some kind of review stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Some reflections of people around stuff. What about on pitch? And
I've sort of reduced it. Yeah, mate, I've really reduced down to four things, really, you know, like that I seem to be pretty critical. So the four things that I sort of focus on with a player would be self-awareness, would be, and that's quite a big bucket, right? So do you understand what it looks like for you to be at your best when you're performing? Okay. And do you understand what the triggers are that take you out of that space? Okay, that'd be one. So you want to be self-regulation. Can you get yourself back? You know, that's a big one, right? If you're getting out, because no good having a self-regulation tool without being aware of your blueprint. So what's your blueprint? When are you going well? You know, and it's normally the same for most people. I'm calm, I'm confident, I'm clear,
I'm not thinking about outcome, you know, that I'm playing what's in front of me. I'm instinctive, all of those things. Well, what takes you out of that? Scoreboard might be one. Scoreboard pressure, right?
Yeah.
That might be one. Someone gives me a clip at a ruck and I'd see red. I make a mistake in the first minute. So, you know, there might be 10 or 15 different reasons that someone, I missed my first kick. That now they're not in that space that they know is critical for them to perform, and they have to self-regulate. That means they have to have the tool to go, one, I recognize I'm not there. How do I get back? So there's lots of tools in that. Then I think the third one is decision-making. So how do I make good decisions? So I sort of have let's call it the rights, okay? So the right decision made at the right time with the right outcome, okay? So I made the right decision. I did it at the right time. So, you know, how do we train that? That's an important thing. But in a game, I think the decision-making is massively, I don't know how you feel. You probably, you know, way more than this about it than I do, but I would anticipate that decision-making gets better as your accumulation of experiences increase. So that picture that you have in front of you 100 times, you learn to make better decisions if that picture is one you've seen before, and then you've had experience. So I think that's the prep realm of, like, how do we create good pitches throughout the week that are going to be similar to what our players will face in a weekend? And then how do we help them to make quality decisions in those moments when it doesn't have a real, real outcome, so that when we put them in that position, they can. And then I think the final thing would be communication. How do I keep communicating well and clearly with my teammates, and I look after them, and I'm aware when I'm doing that and not doing that?
What stuff are you doing around that? I mean, it's the classic answer to coaches, isn't it? What do we need to get better at? Communication.
Yeah, I mean, the communication to me is it's always, I think, you know, I think cricket helped me a lot with this. The right information at the right time about the right thing. Like, that's cricket. Like, we're not just going to go and talk about, you know, cricket's slower, right? So you have the break. So, you know, when a captain and a bowler goes back to the top of their mark, you can have great comms as far as you're talking to each other and useless communication.
Yeah.
So what is the right information, and what is the right time to say that, and what's the right way to communicate it? Okay, I reckon that's really critical. So, but you've got to train that, right? It's not like you just get out on a field on a sad day. You've got to train that through the week. So, like, you know, I know particularly one young guy I've been talking about this year, we're just talking about not the right information, and we're not even talking about the right time. It's in the right way, because he gets angry and he's frustrated and his tone is awful. And everyone stops listening to him, but he doesn't know that he was doing it. And it's condescending rather than helpful. So we had to just work with him and go, mate, I'm going to put up a mirror. Do you understand that when you talk to guys on the field, this is what it sounds like? He's like, oh, I'm not too sure. I go, okay, I'll record it for you. And he's like, oh, really? I'm like, yeah, really? He's like, oh, no, nah, that's no good. Okay. So it's because the camera doesn't lie, right? We say that as a principle. So to be able to have that sometimes is a tool to be able to go, I'm going to show you what you sound and feel like, and like, ooh, geez. So around the actual in the game, I reckon if you think about this, if you're a rugby player, you have a real clear blueprint on what sort of mental state you need to be in to perform well. You recognize when you're getting out of that state, you know how to get back into it. You know what quality decision-making looks like, and you've rehearsed that. And also, you're a great communicator and you have the right message at the right time to the right people. I think you'd be pretty useful on a field day.
Eh? You'd take that. It would definitely,
yeah,
with a bit of the other stuff, that would work well. We did a similar project with a he's now Premiership fly half, but around his communication, what percentage was positive, right, with it towards, what was negative away?
Yeah.
What was command? And what was questioned? So how was he giving other people to think of getting their input? And same again, like, whew, it's like, oh
yeah. And it's, so it's, and like, just to, I think to keep it right, really, really clean, what we're always going back to, your mind will either be an asset or a liability in the performance space. How do we make it an asset? That's all it is. It's simple. And they are some of the things we need to work on for it to be an asset.
Where does that sit with coaches? So would you be exactly the same with coaches, self-awareness, self-regulation, your decision-making, communication?
Yeah,
Yeah, I think with a lot of coaches, I think it's changed. So, you know, I think some of the older coaches who have matured with time would say, we don't quite get the mental side, but we know it's important. Does that make sense? Like, I reckon that's a common sort of sentiment. And we'll try and make room. We don't quite know what it looks like, but we're open to discussion. But I reckon the younger, so coaches under, say, 45, just as a general sort of term, under 50 maybe, I think we understand its importance, we value it, but we don't quite know what to do with it. So I think there's a generate, like when you think about it, as a mental skills coach, my voice is really small in the environment, right? Like if you did a percentage of impact in the environment, mine might only be 5%. The biggest mental skills coach in any environment is the head coach, right? Because as a player and as a staff, that message that you hear from your head coach will be the most powerful and influential and probably resigning message that you might hear all week. You know, so for a player, what they hear from a head coach at the end of training or what they hear from a head coach at the end of the game will be likely the conversation that they'll replay through their brain as they go home, as they go to sleep and they wake up the next morning.
So you're trying to be the last voice a little bit more often.
Well, I can't be the primary voice because it's not my role. You know, my role isn't to be the guardian of the environment and to be the head coach and to direct the ship. You know, that's why I always say, like, the main vision of the team, the main values of the team, the main way that we're going to play, that's a head coach. My job's to come along and support that if I align, right? If I align, support it and provide a way for that to be expressed. So, for example, if we have the vision of winning, you know, the team has a vision. My vision is to win a top 14 title. I'm just saying that just as a, you know, we'll win the Heineken Cup. Is it still the Heineken Cup? What's it called now? Is it
changed?
Yeah. Okay. So when you talk about that, what sort of rugby do we need to play? So that's a big question, right? So then but then under all of that, what sort of environment do we need to create for that to happen? Then under that again, I'd say, well, what sort of mindset are we going to need to have to achieve that task? So I still think the vision and the direction, it's got to lay with the head coach. But my role is to go in there and go, how do we cultivate a mindset that assists and undergirds and makes that vision possible? And there'll be certain things that will be critical. So like if you want to win a Heineken Cup, I would imagine you've got to have a healthy relationship with pressure where you no longer see it something to avoid it, but something to be embraced, and you change the narrative with pressure. You have to, right? If you're going to go to finals and play finals footy. So I think that's a mental skills role. I think that's somewhere a mental skills go, all right, coach, you want to go to Heineken Cup and win finals. How are we going to elevate our players' experience of pressure and preparation? And how are we going to make sure that we're giving them the tools to deal with pressure?
So what type of stuff? So once again, let's take it to the pitch. What are your interactions with coaches look like on the pitch?
I probably don't interrupt a session. That'd be probably the first thing. Probably learn that the hard way is that my role isn't to, in the middle of a session, try and correct the coach. My role, once my relationship with the coaches sort of grows, is probably more like a player relationship, in the sense that I'm not going to march into a coach's office after a training session and give him a list of three things that he needs to work on. One, I don't think that's overly useful at times for coaches. I think they're just, you know, as the trust sort of grows and as the relationship grows, like I think I said to you last week, you build the bridge of trust to drive the truck of honesty over. You know, I've known if I get in there, do my job, build trust, there's always a time where the coach will go, hey, can you help me out with this? Or what do you think about that? And there isn't one role I've ever been in, if I'm doing my job well and building trust with the head coach, even though he might not believe I should be there at the beginning or is curious or even suspicious, eventually they'll want input. But I'm not going to volunteer input, you know, inadvertently, randomly, and offensively to see myself as the main challenger of the head coach in the environment.
What are you most proud of? So give me some examples of moments where you've gone, God, goosebumps.
Yeah. I think I remember, so one of them was a World Series, and there's a guy that
Just to, I think you've won three World Series.
Yeah. Yeah. A guy made of mine won three World Series. I helped out a little bit. So, and we had this whole thing throughout the year. And it was one phrase. It was fail from a strong place. So we're going to fail from courage. We're not going to succeed from fear. That was sort of the whole mindset for the year. So I'm going to go balls to the wall. I'm going to bring out my best stuff and I'm just going to let go. And if I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough. But I'm not going to fail holding back. So as a pitcher, you can hold back. You can sort of direct the pitch rather than let go. You know, just like a pace bowler or a goal kicker probably. So if a goal kicker, for example, could try and point, you know, try and, oh, you know, I can't quite describe, you know, that feeling, where even if you're a line out, rather than just let go, boom, you know, hit it. And I remember watching a World Series. It was game seven. It was a really intense moment. He'd had to come in the second innings because the starter had failed. He ended up pitching four scoreless innings and got his game seven winner of that game. And he stood there and he's left-hander. He's just like this. And I could see him through this on the TV. I was up in the stand. I could see him through the TV. And said, fail from a strong place. Fail from a strong place. Poof! You know, like that was magic because that's where you see the work happening in the biggest occasion. And he's throwing absolute bullets and he's unbelievable. And he's doing it out of courage in the highest pressure situation you could imagine. So on an individual one, that was magic. Like that was just where you see, you know, you made a difference. Does that make sense?
Yeah, mate. And especially around two things really. One is especially big moments around performance. The other thing for me is, probably when you start to see people feel part of a team or belonging or start to understand themselves better. I think last week you talked about some of the language you'd heard from, maybe was it the girls? Was it from football again?
No, I mean, one of the things is in cricket, we did quite a bit of work around this whole notion. I've got to get a better phrase for it. I've only got it in a negative tense. I don't really like it, but I don't know how to say it any better, which is you can't play for a man you don't know. And so we talk about this playing for each other. But you don't know each other. So, and I sort of had this theory in the back of my mind, untested, unscientific, like all of my theories, was that I reckoned empathy created unity under the pump. That I reckon if you knew each other and you connected to each other, I reckon you'd fight for each other and you'd stick together under the pump rather than separate. So I thought, geez, how are we going to create unity or empathy or, you know, how are we going to do that? And I only knew one way that empathy is created through vulnerability. The only way, one way you create trust is through vulnerability. And I've been a huge Brené Brown fan. So I've really, like, I understand those principles of like, man, it takes a lot of courage to be vulnerable. But if you be vulnerable, there's a lot of trust that goes both ways, that people trust you and you trust them if they deal with that vulnerability in an appropriate way. And we had this session, I think, a couple of years ago with this team. And man, it was just blew me away. Like, I think we had like 16 out of 18 guys were in tears and some stuff that no one ever knew about, you know, like guys that had huge mental health issues and were lucky to be alive. That level of, I made it through the off season without taking my life sort of stuff. And other guys, I mean, like, it was like, mate, I'm just sitting there going, you know, like it was just intense. And we sort of made this sort of commitment in that moment is that, and it was interesting because the young kid, you know, that was really quite vulnerable around his own mental health and getting through the off season. And, you know, he ends up becoming our Toastmaster and at all the team events. And if you looked at him now, you wouldn't even know, like you would look at him and go, what a confident, delightful, well-spoken, respectful young man. Ended up being the top wicket taker in domestic one day cricket in New Zealand last year. You know, like, and this is a kid who didn't even want to be there. And belonging created that. Like this sense of I belong here and I'm free to be myself, authentically myself, and I'm not worried about being judged. And so, you know, we had this player, I think the story I was referring to is he went to another team. It was at a higher level of cricket. It was at the next level of international cricket. And he was sort of asked by another guy, hey, when I see you playing for your domestic team, he's like, man, you're so free and you dig in, you just fight. And it's like, you know, you're different here. And he said, oh, yeah, because I really care about that team. I really care about those guys. And the guy said, well, why do you care about them? He goes, I know I'm weird, but they love me for who I am. And that's the magic, because that's not just about performance, NA. That's about people's lives being changed. If we all sort of hold the notion and we all believe that, you know, sport's just a vehicle to help people get better at life, to find enjoyment in life, to find connection in life, and to maximize what they've been given in life, then how serious are we? You know, like, I understand they're athletes and they understand they got to perform, but what a magnificent side benefit, huh, of that, is to see that happen.
I think it's the purpose of sport. I mean, it's talking about even the small minority that are the, you know, the real, you know, win at all costs kind of. Yeah. I still think all that stuff's the most important.
Well, I don't think it makes good coaches. Like, and this one thing I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to articulate and challenge a little bit. And Rush, you know this better than anyone. Like, if I'm sitting before a coach and I don't believe that he cares about me and he wants to be me to be at my best, and all I get from him is anger and hostility, how do I even trust him?
Well, having been coached by people like that, I can tell you, it just didn't get the best out of me. Simple.
Then why do we still allow that sort of coaching to persist? And why do we still think that's a valid expression of coaching, that your main sort of relationship with the athlete is hostility?
I think it's tradition. I think lots of, interestingly, something I'm definitely curious about is parents, some parents I know think that's actually really, really good coaching. And actually, if something looks different to that, then actually that's a bit pink and fluffy and that's not performance. So, I think there's a parental expectation as well around just because of what we received. So if you're a parent and, you know, you don't understand the stuff we're talking about, and you've experienced coaching that looks like this, and you think that's what it should look like. I think it's and I guess also, I still think people are probably a little bit unwilling to challenge the guy or girl, usually the guy, on a Sunday morning that's shouting and screaming, even when I go over and try and just help them a little bit, give them a hug.
So let me ask you a question around that, because I know I'm just going to go the other way here, because one of my real concerns is in professional sport is I call them mortgage coaches, and they coach to pay a mortgage.
Yeah.
And that means they won't be authentic at times. So the chameleons, right? So they don't challenge people. They accept behaviors that they might not even be true to their value system. And they just keep on sort of keeping everyone happy, because if they challenge the coach, they might get fired. If they are authentic, they might get fired. And then all of a sudden I can't pay my mortgage, which is real. I'm not minimizing that. And I sort of made it a real sort of value and sort of like a vow, I suppose, strong word, but a few years ago I found myself in a situation supporting a coach that I didn't believe that he was doing a very high paying job, and I resigned. And, you know, everyone, my wife was like, what do you do? I said, I can't be true to myself here. And it was one of the hardest decisions ever, but it was really, but it was almost like this whole relief and weight came off my shoulders the moment I did it. And I was like, I can be myself again. Like, what do you think? Like, do you see, not an epidemic, it might be too strong of a word, but do you see a lot of coaches that have fallen into the trap of paying their mortgage?
I mean, I guess, depends where you see it. So I would say, look, if you love your family and kids and you want to keep them safe and sheltered, then you might want a house. And so I would kind of, I would sell it on that for some people. And I can endorse you. I mean, being relieved of my duties at the RFU was the most liberating experience I ever had, because I wouldn't consider myself complicit, because I was definitely trying to do something about it. But I mean, I would speak to lots of coaches, assistant coaches, and this is one of their biggest challenges is, but it looks like this, and I can't have that conversation, because actually either I get sacked, or, you know, I just don't know how that person's going to react to me, quite frankly. I think it's tough. I think it's a real exhausting place to be, and in England, for example, I mean, well, one of your Super Rugby coaches had the owner of his club trying to tell him how to coach attack. So it actually became even more complicated than that. So I think it's as you would anyway. Yeah. One of the things I try and understand when I go anywhere is the context of what's influencing people's behavior. Mm. And so it might be that you coach like this because the academy manager expects it, or because ECCC, which is the kind of the governing body's version of events, requires that you record the what of coaching as opposed to the kind of the interactions. Mm. So I guess I'm always trying to understand people's context. And in answer to your question, I see a lot of people and it's really tough on their mental health.
Yeah, they're stuck, right? Like, what are they going to do? If I say something, I might not be able to pay my mortgage and look after my family. But tolerating this is eating away at me every single week. It's a tough spot, right?
Yeah, I'm my wife. So I would have had it with for my 2 years at the RFU where, well, you speak, you know, the person that helps you make sense of the world, your wife, you know, she hears the same story 1,000 times and we're still coming to the same answer.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, most coaches I know can do the tech stuff quite easily. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the stuff we're speaking about. And I think coach well-being is going to become more and more kind of important. Well, it is already more and more important, isn't it? We get stories of people burning out or coaches that commit suicide or, you know, end up in hospitals. And so I think it's, creating that environment where coaches can thrive as well, where they can have high performance moments rather than, you know, they spend all their lives at, you know, just on a treadmill. And the fact that people have now got time to think, so, you know, and interact with people like you and learn, and I think it's going to be really important in sports. Like, it's going to be so important for people's lives.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's so true.
It's stuff that I'm always, guess I'm thinking about. What would be your advice to, so, Sunday morning, mum or dad, coaching on their own, which is also challenging, and they don't have a mental skills coach available to them. What would be your advice for those people?
Yeah, I think it goes back to parenting, right? So, you know, I've got a 15-year-old and a 16-year-old and 11-year-old. So, you know, if I was a parent of them, bringing them to sports, and you know, like my son's got, I love my son's cricket coach. I reckon he's the man. I just love him. And he gets all coy when I'm around and like, oh no, what are we doing? And he's the best. I love
him. You need to stop turning up like with a camera and
notepad. Yeah, yeah, yeah. For under 12s cricket. But he's so cool. And there's two things that he's done for my son that I'm going to be grateful for. He always gets tickets to games whenever he wants them. They're sort of like, whenever you want tickets, mate, you let me know. He's fostered a love for the game, right? He's fostered that. So what do I mean by that? He said the game is about being fun and enjoying with a bunch of friends. That's the first reason you play sport, and may that never change, okay? And the second thing he's done is and this goes back to our parenting, right? How do we bring the best out of people? Well, how do we bring in the best out of our children? There's one or two options. It's constantly reminding them at how poor they are at the things that we don't like about them. That's option one. Option two is affirming and encouraging them, that voice being louder in the things that we do like what they do. So people don't change through shame. They change through encouragement, effective change, right? You might have short-term change through guilt or embarrassment or shame, but be really short-term. Long-term change happens when you're encouraged, you feel supported, you see a pathway on how you're going to get there, and you know you don't have to do it by yourself. And so for me, if I was coaching under 12, then two things I'd say. Number one measure of success each week is fun, not winning. And people go, oh, that's a bit soft. No, it's not. We're not trying to win championships at 12. What we're trying to do is develop young people who will love the game for the rest of their lives. Because tell me one thing you got good at that you don't love. You know, there's a few things, not long-term, right? There's a few things. Like, but if you love it, you normally will find the motivational pathway and energy to get better at your craft. If you don't love it, you won't. It'll be a chore. It'll be a job.
I love eating, and it's not helping me lose weight.
Mate, I love eating too. I am an absolute world champion in the kitchen. But, you know, like, you look at that and go, why can't we foster a love for the game? And the second thing is, how do we believe people get the best out of themselves? And how do we help in that? So when you get beside a person, go, my job is real simple here. I'm going to give you the tools. I'm going to encourage you, and I'm going to support you, and I'm going to make you feel like you don't have to do this by yourself. And let's see how far we can go on that journey. That's coaching to me. And so that's the human part of coaching, I suppose. And I think when we've got a parent on a weekend, you're trying to coach young people to be great young people and be good at their sport. I don't think it's an either or.
No, I agree. What do you notice when your son, what do you notice on the way to cricket training and after it and during it for your son?
He talked about all his mates. Not about how what he learned. That's cool though, right? Like, he talked about how much he enjoyed hanging out with his mates, and, you know, and then they always go for a swim after training in the sea or at the coach's house, and they do bombs and they swim in the pool. And I mean, I don't know. That's, mate, I think, I don't know. I think
how many champions they won? Seriously, come on.
They were awesome. They were good. They're good. Of course they're good. But they're good because they love the game and they love being together. And so I reckon, like, we're in a unique position, like being in professional sport. That's where I live. I reckon when you see the purity, you love it more. And then you go, how do I still capture that, even in the highest of professional environments?
That's what I think. That actually, almost they need it more. Like the old people who've, you know, been ground down by stuff. They're actually craving. Look how excited they get. Yeah. So whenever I go and, you know, we start off and go, oh, you guys just get a game going with the coaches. Mm. It's like, I'll pull a couple out and go, could you just give them some feedback on how ridiculously excited they are? I mean, seriously, it's crazy. Why is no one even starting sessions with games? Mm. It's so important. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I reckon also, and you might have seen this, I reckon the evidence of a really healthy environment is creativity. Because I reckon if you're trying stuff, it means you feel safe. So when my son goes, I'm just going to try and bowl leg break this for the next 3 weeks. And then, like, honestly, he plays on a Saturday, he'll do 2 pace, 2 off spin, and 2 leg break in an over. Because there's no risk for him. I'm just having fun. I'm just trying to be creative, and I'm just experiment, see if I can get the guy out. And we'll give it a go, eh? Like, don't you think that's a really safe environment? Like, and when you see a non-creativeness within the players, that they're too scared to try, I wonder if the consequences of failure are too high.
I agree with everything you just said. I think it's a beautiful way of putting it, that the evidence is creativity. Interestingly, the coaches, you know, when stuff doesn't happen in a game and they go, oh, why didn't he kick that? They're often not looking at themselves. And the environment. Well,
you think about it from a mindset. Like, if you have a fear-based mindset, that the only behaviors you can produce are boring and predictable, right? And so you can't do anything else. If you have a fun-based or a enjoyment-based mindset, you'll have instinct, you'll have creativity, and you'll have innovation. Because the enemies of creativity and risk and innovation, the enemy of that is fear of failure. So if we take fear out of a scenario, we release our players to actually begin to explore everything that's within them from a creative, expressive, instinctual, innovative place. And all we ask them week after week is play what's in front of you. But how can they play what's in front of them if their mindset isn't facilitating that principle?
Where have you seen that does this well? So, or where have you heard of, which places are you aware of that might be? So my number one is always the Brit School. So it's a school, it's a state school in London, bit of an emphasis around the arts. And you triggered me, actually. So there was a kid there and I thought, in any other school, this kid would be bullied. However, they love him here because he's different. And just the headmaster knew everyone's names. He hugged me, the first headmaster to ever hug me, my first meeting with him. I mean, just that kind of, it's just an incredible environment, really.
Yeah, I don't know if I've seen it fully mature, because I don't know if, because it's a hugely challenging. And the challenging reason for coaches is, I think it's a sense of, sometimes we see innovation, risk, creativity as being a lack of preparation, where I see it as the product of preparation. And so I don't think they have to go against. So you earn the right to express yourself through a dedication to the foundation of skills that you already possess. And so it's not like, you know, we teach a cricketer a reverse sweep before they've learned forward defense, but their commitment to forward defense allows them then to be expansive in the rest of their game, right? That would be an example.
Yeah.
Where then, so the foundation of discipline is still the foundation which allow creativity and innovation and risk to come out of an instinctual stuff. So I think some coaches feel that if we take, I don't know, if we release the handbrake, for use of a better term, are we creating permission for recklessness? And I would say not if you've trained your team well, because the difference between courage and stupidity, or courage and recklessness, is preparation.
Nice. Who's giving you feedback? So and who are you learning?
You got to talk to him next week. So, he's been a huge part of. Cool.
I mean, I love the fact that you've, over many, many years, and I know some other coaches that would have similar kind of processes. Mm. You speak to Owen Eastwood, who I'm going to speak to next week, and has got a book that gave me goosebumps when you mentioned
it. Yeah, he's amazing, incredible man.
Every week for years.
Yeah. For the last year, I think we're on year two or three now, like every Friday. I mean, it's 45 Fridays out of 52. It's not like every week, but it's pretty common. And what I think is that it goes back to what we've talked about earlier. I so trust them. Like, the evidence from our relationship is he always wants what's best for me, and he's cared for me really well through tough times, especially. So when he gives me feedback, I'm never questioning the veracity of the feedback. So I think this goes back to what we talked about before, is that, you know, if we have a hostile coach, all he delivers is honesty, but he doesn't deliver care, then the question mark will always remain over his feedback, whether it's done out of a pure place or not. And so, you know, like, I think the SAS in New Zealand did something pretty wonderful the last number of years, where they said optimal resilience or optimal growth for people occurs where you have both care and challenge in the right balance. And so if it's all challenge, it's quite brutal, right? If it's all care, then there's no growth, you know, because there's no pushing the envelope out a little bit. And so I think with someone like Owen, for example, or any mentor that people have out there that's meaningful in their lives, is that you've done the work of trust and care that's now given the right for challenge and honesty. And so, you know, I've seen young people who try and have gone to some like critical conversation course or honest feedback course. And then like in day two, they're trying to work through the principles they've learned and deliver your feedback. And you're like, you haven't earned the right. You don't, giving feedback to right, you earn that. And you earn it through care and trust. And if you want to short circuit that process, you'll never get effective change in people. And so someone, you know, like Owen or some of your friendships and mentoring relationship you have, I suppose I've granted them big permission to be pretty honest with me because I have a high level of trust.
Yeah. When Fletch says to me, can I give you some feedback?
Yeah.
I know it's going to be really important.
Yeah, well, you're not going through all the mental gymnastics of what's the angle, what's the motive, what's it's just, it's care. You know he cares. So you'll take it for what it is. Doesn't mean you agree with it, but you'll take it because you know where it's coming from.
Nice. Mate, I'm going to finish with the one word is I'm going to actually, before that, you've got a podcast listener the other day. Do you want to tell people about it?
Yeah, I've just sort of started a podcast called Head Noise, so you can sort of find it on the usual sort of things. And I sort of wanted to take athletes as we see them and sort of peel back the layers and go, okay, we always talk about these games being hugely mental, or, you know, some of the wrong sort of stuff that people, that's 90% mental, it's not. But there is a mental component to performance. How do they actually prepare for it? Is it part of their life? And what does that look like both on and off the field? And sort of what we talked about earlier, is that I think there's a huge appetite. People want to know about that side of performance, but it's almost a bit mysterious. So I want to once again normalize it or demystify it, whatever term you want to use, to also think, okay, if these guys are using these things to be at the best, what does it look like for the person listening to incorporate some of that into their life? So I'm not just doing sports. I've done a few sports. I've done a couple of cricketers. Lachie Ferguson, talked to him a lot about the World Cup final from last year. So that would be of interest, particularly for our English listeners. Wasn't of much interest to me, but for the English it was. And what was that like to go through that? I'm actually going to do a one with Martin Guptill just here in the next few months on the final over. I'm just going to talk for half an hour on facing Archer and what was he thinking, what was he going through. And we're going to try and bring up footage of it and just walk that through that with him. So that'd be really interesting.
Yeah, that'd be class. Yeah.
And then Kieran Foran, who was a huge player in the NRL, had some massive issues on and off the field, and amazing story. And so that's sort of been the whole point of it. So I'm just sort of at the beginning of it, and I'm interested, and I'm going to do some of my baseball guys soon. That'll be interesting to get an American voice on there.
Nice. I can recommend it. I mean, I just love the peeling back the layers and, you know, that would fuel all my biases. And you're not on Twitter, but you are Most Improved Man on LinkedIn.
Yeah, that's my claim to fame. I am on Twitter, but I follow people I don't post. Huh? I'm like a stalker, professional stalker.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't have enough bandwidth to do multiple platforms. Can manage, can't look after myself, different accounts.
Cool. I'm going to finish with the one-worders. So yeah. One-word answers, and then you're going to get some sleep. Rugby.
Fun. Exciting.
New Zealand.
Proud.
Coaching.
People.
Chiefs.
Mana.
Baseball.
America.
the next one was America. America.
Baseball. No, my wife. I should say my wife.
Yeah, you
my
should definitely American. Say your wife.
Yeah, my wife.
That would be useful. Belonging.
Family.
Mate, it's amazing. The next one is actually family. Belonging.
Belonging.
Yeah. And last one, mental skills.
Potential.
Yeah, I would agree. Mate, it's been a pleasure.
Mate, it's awesome.
At least as good as first time.
It's different. I like we went in a different direction. I really enjoyed both of them equally.
Yeah. No, mate, it was cool for me. Yeah. We'll definitely jump on another one at another stage, I'm sure, mate. Yeah, fantastic. Been a pleasure. Go and spend time with your family. Go and feel some belonging, and we'll catch up soon.
Okay, mate. Thank you very much.